From Oregon to Florida, Texas to Maryland, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, remote and mobile workers face a daunting array of tax challenges when they work in multiple states. Andrew Wilford from the National Taxpayers Union Foundation joins us for a look at the problem. There have been major developments this past week in U.S. Senate races in North Carolina and Georgia. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Simply raising payroll taxes on younger workers is not a solution to the pending insolvency of the Social Security system. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Romina Baccia of the Cato Institute. And the socialist-leaning voters who nominated Zoran Mamdani for mayor of New York will get a real lesson on what living under socialism actually means. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Remote and mobile workers often must pay income taxes to multiple states. It can be a daunting task. Andrew Wilford is director of the Interstate Commerce Initiative at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. He's looked into which states make filing easy and which are difficult. Andrew, welcome to American Radio Journal. Andrew, what segment of the workforce are we talking about here? You've done a very in-depth analysis on how various state policies can affect them, but tell us the type of worker that we are discussing.
This used to be a much smaller segment of the population that had to worry about issues like this. So we're talking about mainly people who are remote workers, so remote worker being someone who works away from like a primary job site, so often from home, but you know, not in the office, not at the job site. But these things can also affect people who just travel for work, or even travel just in the course of their normal, you know, their normal lives. They go visit family and they do some work while they're there. These things can all have tax implications that I think people might not realize that they might have.
So if I'm working from, say, the state of Pennsylvania, but I decide to go for a month or two to live in Florida, mm-hmm. that has tax implications?
Well, because Florida doesn't have an income tax, but depending on the state that you go to, yes. And that's part of what makes it so complicated. You know, it's hard to know. What does the state I'm traveling to, does this have tax implications? And, you know, I wish I could give you a simple answer, but the real answer is you kind of have to look at the report we did, because that's what gets into, you know, what the different rules are by state. But it really shouldn't be that way. You shouldn't have to look up my report to know if you have to pay tax for spending a day or two in a state.
Well, first of all, kudos to Florida for not having the tax word that way everywhere in the country. Okay, your report, it's known as the Rome, R-O-A-M, Index. Mm-hmm. What does that stand for, and what is the report looking at?
It stands for the Remote Obligations and Mobility Index. Really, what we're looking at is what are the tax compliance burdens specifically that each state puts on people who are non-residents. So they travel into the state for a few days. They work remotely for a business that's in the state. You know, how well does the state try and reduce these sort of unnecessary paperwork burdens that don't really serve much purpose either for the person who has to deal with them or for the State Department of Revenue, which has to, you know, process all these returns that are, you know, for just a few bucks. It's really kind of it should be a common sense thing that we just want to simplify and take out, you know, address these unnecessary burdens. But a lot of times, you know, states, either they just haven't gotten around to it or, you know, in some cases, like, not to name names, but I'll name names, New York and California, there's sort of a intentional effort to rake in more money from people who are out of state and can't you know, vote them out because they're non-residents. So that's really what we're looking at here.
Now, as always, some states, as you've mentioned, do better than others. Tell us what states do the best for the worker. Keep this as simple as possible, and why the policies they have make it that way.
The states that make it as simple as possible, you know, we mentioned earlier, it's the states that don't have an income tax. There's no income tax, then there's no then there's nothing for you to file about, you know. But for states that do have an income tax, the best one is Indiana. And what Indiana does really two things that set it apart from a lot of states. First, it has what are called safe harbors for people who are traveling into the state. So, you know, as I mentioned, in many states, if you spend a single day working in that state, you have to file a tax return in that state. You might not know you have to. You might not be doing it and not know that you're not that you're breaking the law by not doing it. But Indiana makes it simple. It says that if you're not here for more than 30 days, then don't worry about it. There's no tax implications. Your employer doesn't have to be withholding tax on your behalf. You don't have to file a tax return until you spend more than 30 days here. There's nothing to worry about. That's sort of the gold standard. We've seen a few other states do this, but Indiana has one of the best rules in that regard. The second thing they do is they have what are called reciprocity agreements with a lot of neighboring states. And these are agreements where each state says, okay, if people are traveling across state lines, so you live in Ohio and you travel to work in Indiana, we're each just going to agree that you just pay tax in your home state. So the Ohio resident who works in Indiana doesn't have to, you know, pay Indiana income tax, then credit it on their own Ohio state return. They just pay Ohio tax. It's much simpler. It's much easier. And then Indiana does the same thing back with vice versa. So they have a lot of these agreements and things like that. They just make, they're kind of common sense because they don't have much of an impact on state finances. But at the same time, they make things a lot easier for people who just happen to cross state borders in the course of their work.
And conversely, let's talk for a minute or so here about the states that make it the most difficult for remote and mobile workers. We typically know which states end at the bottom of anything when it comes to taxes, but why don't you give us the rundown anyhow?
You probably wouldn't be surprised to hear that New York is right at the bottom, but actually Delaware is one of the worst states here too. Both these states are, you know, day one, you have to file a tax return, not surprising. What sets them apart is they each have what are called convenience of the employer rules. If that sounds nice, if not, it doesn't facilitate convenience. They essentially say that if you used to work by traveling into state, so say you're in the case of New York, if you're a New Jersey resident and you used to travel into New York, but then you switch to working remotely, so you're just living in New Jersey, you're working full-time in New Jersey, you're, you know, maybe barely even setting foot in the state of New York, you have to pay tax to New York. That's a real, it's a real problem because it can create double taxation. Because when you turn around and try and credit, you know, the tax you paid to New York to New Jersey, New Jersey's going to say, hey, you were living here, you were working here, you know, we don't have to, you owe us tax, we don't have to credit you tax. So then taxpayers get sort of stuck in a tug of war between two state revenue departments. And really, it's New York's fault because they're the ones who have this silly rule. But you know, the upshot is that the taxpayer is the one who's dealing with having to sort this out. So it's a real, financial burden. Both New York and Delaware have rules like that and really sets them apart at the bottom.
We have been talking with Andrew Wilford, who is director of the Interstate Commerce Initiative at the National Taxpayers Union. We've been talking about the Rome Index, remote and mobile workers. Tell us a little bit about NTU, Andrew, and where can folks find this report?
NTU, National Taxpayers Union, we try and advocate for taxpayers at the federal level. You know, there's a lot of A lot of lobbyists here in Washington, but we try and think of ourselves as the taxpayers' lobbyist. We advocate for lower taxes and some restraint on runaway federal spending. So you can see us our website at ntu.org, nice and simple, and then the report is at ntu.org/ROAM. So ntu.org/ROAM.
Andrew Wilford of the National Taxpayers Union. Andrew, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We have a couple of barn burner races that are going to take place in a couple of key states for the U.S. Senate next year, North Carolina and Georgia. Major developments. We're going to talk with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be back, Loman. Thank you.
Let us go first to the Tar Heel State, North Carolina. Tell us what's transpired over the last few days.
About a month ago, during the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, Trump and Tom Tillis got into it over Medicaid, and ultimately Tillis decided not to seek re-election. So it created an open Republican primary, and for a long time, Democrats have viewed North Carolina as their best pickup opportunity in the Senate for 2026. So there was a lot of sort of back and forth within Washington, D.C., and within the White House, and within the media, and obviously within North Carolina on who the Republican nominee is going to be. Is there going to be a competitive primary where we deplete resources and give the Democrat a better chance at winning? Or are we going to unify behind a single individual? I think that question, whether we're going to unify, is still out there. But there are major developments this week. The first one is that Roy Cooper, the former attorney general and former governor, Democrat from North Carolina, is planning to announce for the U.S. Senate next week. And I guarantee you, he is going to be the Democrat nominee. He's going to, sail through their primary process. They're going to unify behind him, and he's going to be incredibly well-funded. And then on the Republican side, this week we learned through various news reports that Lara Trump is going to stay at Fox, and she and the Trump family are reportedly going to unify their support behind the Republican National Committee Chairman, Michael Whatley. And so Whatley is the guy that replaced Ronna McDaniel a couple of years ago and obviously helped usher in a winning strategy alongside Susie Wiles and Chris LaCivita to pick up, I think they went 6-for-6 in all those major swing states. And now, that's a pretty big feather in his cap when you're talking about leading a major organization. Trump's been very satisfied with that. And the news that they're planning to offer their support to Whatley is, an encouraging sign that we can save money in a primary process and, hopefully retain that seat, because right now we just have 53 seats in the U.S. Senate. And we've seen what happens when Susan Collins and maybe some of the other moderates peel off on various votes. So North Carolina, I think, is a huge, huge race to watch. But it looks like we're going to avoid big, costly primaries. And Michael Whatley and Roy Cooper are going to be the nominees of their respective parties. So then you go a little bit farther south, and you're down in Georgia. And John Ossoff is up for re-election. He's the youngest Democrat senator. He's raised the most money last quarter, according to the FEC reports. And I also think he's the most vulnerable Democrat. Georgia is a state that President Trump wins in. And we're learning this week that we should also be expecting an announcement soon from a MAGA, America First type member of the House of Representatives, Mike Collins. Collins has a tremendous voting record. He's fairly new to Congress. I think he's been there for about 2.5 years. And I think he's sort of what, Trumpism is inside of Georgia. So when you think about an America First policy around immigration, Mike Collins was the author of the Laken Riley Act. And, obviously there's going to be, I think, a very competitive primary in Georgia, unlike North Carolina, where, number one, you have a runoff election in Georgia, where the top two of the party will advance to a runoff election, and then you'll have a general election after that. Collins will be running against Buddy Carter, another member of the House of Representatives. And then John King is another statewide elected official in Georgia that's looking at running. So, you know, Georgia is a big pickup opportunity for us. I think that in the general election of 2026, when all's said and done, both of these races, Georgia and North Carolina, are $100 million investments. And I'd rather have a fiscal conservative like Mike Collins in there, even if it costs us $100 million to get him elected, compared to, you know, a blue leftist John Ossoff, who's going to go ahead with everything that either Chuck Schumer or AOC, when she defeats Chuck Schumer, has to offer. And so these are two big races. They're probably the two biggest races of the 2026 midterm. And I hope all your listeners are watching closely in the coming weeks as we see these developments unfold.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, as we always do. Tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We're working closely with members of Congress and the House and Senate to advance pro-growth economic policies that defend liberty, opportunity, and prosperity in America. If you want to learn more, visit us at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
You're welcome.
Making the Social Security system solvent only by raising payroll taxes would be a big financial blow to younger workers. To find out why, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Romina Baccia of the Cato Institute.
The problem facing Social Security is, as a matter of math, not all that difficult to understand. There's too much money going out and not enough coming in. More benefits are being paid out than payroll taxes are being collected. And again, as a matter of math alone, it's not difficult to solve that problem. You either need fewer benefits or you need more taxes coming in. But as my guest today is going to point out, the cost of solving that problem with tax increases alone is unjust and unaffordable for young workers. It would be a six-figure hit to the average worker in America today to solve the Social Security crisis purely with more payroll taxes. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That aforementioned guest is my friend Romina Baccia from the Cato Institute. She's the director of budget and entitlement policy for Cato, and she's one of the co-authors of a new report that they have put out looking at the lifetime earnings hit that younger workers would take to keep Social Security solvent. I think it's a really crucial detail in what is going to be a very important debate over the future of this obviously very important program. Romina joins us now to talk about it. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into the details of a new report that you guys have published at Cato, did I get that basically right? That's more or less the problem with Social Security here. Too much money going out, not enough coming in.
You know, that's one problem. That's sort of the mathematical problem with Social Security. Another problem, and we don't address this in this most recent piece, which is focused on just the increase in taxes that a median worker would have to pay to keep Social Security solvent. But another problem is an economic problem, and that is people retiring earlier than they otherwise would, because all of a sudden they have all this cash coming their way, and if they continue working, they end up having to continue paying payroll taxes and not getting any additional returns for those additional taxes. The question when you hit 62, 65, 67, or 70 is, do you want to be on the receiving end of the Social Security program, or do you want to continue to be on the funding end, paying for the benefits of those people who decided to retire?
So tell us a bit about this report. Now, the headline here is that young workers could lose over six figures, over $100,000 in lifetime earnings, if we solve the Social Security crisis just purely with payroll tax increases.
Yes, we looked at a median worker, so that's someone earning roughly $70,000 a year. We actually simulated their lifetime earnings. So we don't assume that, you know, if you first entered the workforce at 22, that you're going to make $70,000 off the bat. You might have some years where you make over $100,000. And when you first enter the workforce, you might be making a lot less than that. And so we account for that, and we look at workers' actual earnings path. So we have a good example of someone who's sort of middle class in the United States. And for that worker, the tax increase on an annual basis to keep Social Security solvent indefinitely, so avoiding any benefit cuts into the indefinite future, would be $3,500 a year of additional taxes. And that's just for 1 year. When you look at that worker's lifetime taxes, how much more they would have to pay, or how much more time they would have to spend working to pay Social Security benefits of retirees, you're looking at almost $160,000 for that median earner.
Once again, we're talking with Romina Baccia. She's the Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute, one of the co-authors of this new report looking at the cost, the huge cost, six-figure cost, that it would be on current workers, on a median worker, to fill the Social Security gap, if you will, with just higher payroll taxes rather than looking at cuts to benefits. Romina, just about a minute left here. I think what's really striking to me about this is that we so often talk about Social Security in terms of the senior citizens' perspective on this, right? I mean, and understandably so. Political campaigns are built around the desires and interests of older Americans because they vote in larger numbers. This kind of turns that on its head in a way that's really important, because it ultimately will be people who are currently in their 20s and 30s and 40s that are going to have to deal with this problem when it hits a few years from now.
Yes, I think we really need to grapple more with the question of how we are going to keep the American dream alive for younger generations. We're increasingly being saddled with unsustainable entitlement promises, Social Security being one example, Medicaid and Medicare being the others. The roughly 40 cents of every dollar the federal government spends benefits the population 65 and older. We really have a huge intergenerational wealth transfer that is taking place in this country from younger working Americans who on net have many fewer assets to older retired Americans who tend to be much, much wealthier just because they've had their entire lifetimes to save and work and amass assets. We have this redistribution in reverse, if you will, the Robin Hood principle in reverse, where we're actually taking money from working families while they need it to make investments in their families and their businesses and establish their lives, and transferring that money for the consumption of older Americans, and not based on need, but just simply based on age. And we need to rethink that social contract because it's fundamentally unfair and it's unaffordable.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Unfair and unaffordable. It's certainly both of those things, and it's a crisis that is coming, whether we acknowledge it or not. Romina, we are out of time for today, but thanks so much for joining us. Always appreciate talking to you.
Thanks, Eric.
Hey, and once again, that is Romina Baccia. She's the Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute. Check out their new report. Young workers could lose $110,000 in lifetime earnings to keep Social Security solvent. That's the headline there. You can find it at cato.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out our coverage of budget and spending issues and everything going on in D.C. and around the country at reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Zoran Mamdani promises to turn New York City into a socialist paradise. But on this American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, explains why his supporters are about to learn a harsh lesson.
Count me all in. Well, I'm being sarcastic. For the mayoral candidacy of Zoran Mamdani in New York City. Mamdani is a literal democratic socialist, a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, which proudly bills itself, quote, the largest socialist organization in the United States, unquote. In a crazy development, Mamdani recently won the New York City Democratic primary, setting him up for November. He benefited from a surge of support from young people who, frankly, understandably, didn't like his opponent, the corrupt Andrew Cuomo, but who also think they like socialism because, well, they don't understand socialism. Mamdani won the primary by promising young people everything from rent control to a $30 per hour minimum wage, yes, to my personal favorite, government stores. Yes, government stores. Heretofore, Americans have associated government stores with places like, the old Soviet Union, Bulgaria, East Germany, Venezuela, Havana, Pyongyang. Needless to say, in those places, such stores were infamous for lack of everything, as drab, depressed denizens of Marxism queued up for their monthly rations. But like a true socialist, Mamdani learned no lesson from that. In fact, as a product of American universities, he probably never had a single lesson on it. Mamdani actually hails from Uganda, and he seems to be prescribing, Ugandan economic policies for the Big Apple. Though one wonders if even Idi Amin, another big fan of socialism, would have chuckled at any attempt to bring government stores to New York City. But as a faithful socialist, Mamdani knows that the dream never dies. Utopia is always within reach, if only the right people can seize power and your tax dollars. And thus, the wide-eyed socialist is calling for 5 huge city-owned grocery stores, one in each borough, neatly centrally planned, which he says would magically lower the cost of food. He speaks of these marvels in a wondrous way, gushing at the horizon of possibilities that your government could bring to you. To that end, I would really love to see Mamdani's dream enacted for a little while as a wake-up call to the hopelessly woke. When I walk around the streets of New York, I'm always awestruck at the spectacle of liberals thronging restaurants, cafes, pubs, and untold numbers of high-end shops that stand as an incredible testimony to the extraordinary productive power of free markets, which happens to be the very thing that these progressives often vote against. Their intellectual disconnect from the realities abounding around them is a sight to behold. They sit in coffee shops with laptops in Manhattan adorned with stickers proclaiming, "Resist capitalism, support socialism," oblivious to the fact that everything they're daily enjoying is a product not of socialism, but of capitalism. It never ceases to amaze me. As for the stores teeming around them, these progressives pack into monuments to free markets, such as, say, the impressive Trader Joe's on the Upper West Side, replete with escalators down the street from Columbus Circle, with no awareness that free markets have given them such vast choices. Well, alas, under Zohar and Mamdani's proposal, their beloved Trader Joe's and every other store would be forced to compete with government-created stores. Such entities being owned and run by government will be nowhere near as successful. However, they'll have a massive advantage, namely, an unlimited largesse of tax money to suckle from. The government stores will be unmitigated failures, kept from completely failing because they'll be backed and bailed out by government, by tax dollars taken from citizens' paychecks. When private sector stores suffer from inflation and competition, they struggle and sometimes go out of business. Government, however, faces no such threat. Big Brother has their back. But if your private sector operation goes bankrupt, you exit the marketplace. When government goes bankrupt, it gets reelected and gets more of your money. It's quite the competitive advantage. Of course, over time, Mamdani's giant government stores would inevitably degenerate into empty, cavernous boondoggles, massive eyesores for all to see as testimonies to the moral, financial decrepitude of democratic socialism. Really, it would be deliciously amusing to watch young liberal New Yorkers slowly see the stupidity of what they voted for. It might even eventually dawn on them that this is dumb because, democratic socialism is dumb. Well, maybe it might dawn on them. Will it? Maybe. One can dream. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KBRT-AM and KNSN-AM in Costa Mesa, California, along with WSIA-AM in Staten Island, New York. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.